Committee to order this morning, and we'll start with a work session on House Bill 2501. Janet, can you sort of catch us back up to where we're at?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2501 is the bill that would authorize the Department of Transportation to raise or lower speed limits on the interstate highway system in Oregon if the agency has had engineering and traffic investigations that justify a change in the speed. It specifies that the upper limit of 65 miles an hour for trucks and buses and 75 miles an hour for other vehicles. It provides that the interstate's posted speeds will be speed limits, not basic rule, and modifies the speeding penalties to account for the speed limits that are over 65 miles an hour. I've indicated on the staff member summary a little bit of the discussion from the last meeting, and the background contains a little bit of what our neighboring states have for speed limits, if you'll recall some of that discussion. We have a fiscal impact that you have not seen before this morning, indicating that if the department in the middle paragraph of the comment section, if the department is asked to study a specific stretch of highway to revise the maximum speed limit, significant resources may be required for the necessary engineering and traffic studies. The department's budget assumes some engineering and traffic studies now. Depending on the number of bills that pass during the session, it will depend on whether they have sufficient resources to do these studies. There's also the issue of not covered in the fiscal impact of sign changes, but if there are a limited number of sign changes, that it won't be expensive as if the entire state needed to be changed at the same time. So that's a fiscal impact, Mr. Chair, and just catching up that the meeting was March 3rd that we had this hearing, and so you should have the amount of material in your packets from all the testimony of those meetings. And there's no additional testimony today as far as I know.
Thank you, Janet. Committee, we're passing out the Dash 1 amendments, which essentially would lower it from 75 to 70. And
Mr. Chair?
Representative His Honor.
I would move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2501.
Representative His Honor moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2501. Is there any discussion? Representative Gilman.
Mr. Chair, does this reduce the truck speed to 60 then?
No. The only thing it would impact is the it would change the cars from 75 to 70.
But it 70, would and then so the trucks would stay at 65.
Yes. Right. Any other discussion? And also, though, Representative Gilman, it would still be at the discretion of the agency.
Of ODOT, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Doug, could I have you come forward and explain if this law was, or if this was to become law, give us an idea how this would be implemented and what kind of physical impact that might have.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, good morning. Doug Tindall, State Maintenance Engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I haven't seen the fiscal Troy's here. Troy Costales is here. He may know what the impact on signing is. But let me tell you in general what would happen if you pass this bill. There'd probably be requests for areas of the freeway to do a study to see if it was safe to increase the speed. Speed study for a freeway, no different than speed study for any other road. You go out and you assess a number of factors, including how close things are to the roadway, how curvy the geometrics of the road, and also both in the sense of horizontal and vertical, how much traffic there is a factor, and then you do some measurements of the speed and determine how fast people are actually driving. if you've been on I-5 between Salem and Portland, you know that the speed is sort of a guideline, and people tend to drive at a speed that they feel comfortable driving, and so that's a factor, not the only factor, but that's a factor as well. So anywhere where a speed limit change was proposed, we would do the speed study and see if it was indeed safe to raise the speed limit. Once that happens, in whatever section that you have that you're raising the speed limit, you have to change the signs, and that's where the fiscal comes in. How extensive that will be, of course, is dependent on where the studies are, but that's where a fiscal would happen, is that you would have to change the speed signs.
Doug, who would propose these studies, or how would you...
Chair Brown, studies can be proposed by the road authority, by us, or by locals, or by individuals, that usually groups of individuals, could be local government, could come through a local government, could just be individuals saying, hey, this is an unreasonable speed limit out here. We should be able to travel faster than that.
Thank you, Doug. Troy, could I ask you, come forward, please. And what I had to ask is, can you give me some sort of idea how much these studies would cost?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. The fiscal provided for this bill is, if you would, from a reactive mode versus a proactive. Because it allows the studies to be done, allows the request to come in, that's what the fiscal is based on. It's based on probably doing two or three during the biennium. A typical speed evaluation study is about $5,000. However, that's on non-interstate. It probably may be a little higher because you're dealing with more lanes of traffic, three lanes in each direction versus only one or two. But average is about $5,000 just for the speed study part, not including any of the signs.
Thank you, Troy. Representative Greenland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it your experience, do you do follow-up studies on speed studies? So do you know what happens when you raise the speed limit on a...
Chair Brown, Representative Greenlick, we might in some cases, if particularly there's a whole process of people can contend that the speed shouldn't be changed, and it goes through a hearings panel, and under those situations we'd be more likely to do a speed study. The other thing that would cause us to go back and do a follow-up study would be if we saw an increase in number of accidents. But as a rule, you don't go out and do another study right after you've done one to set the speed limit.
Follow up.
So you don't have any idea. The real question is, do speeds increase when the speed limit increases? And I wonder if you've had any experience measuring.
You want to take that? Or you want me to? Chair Brown, Representative Greenlake, if we set the speed correctly, the speed that people are actually traveling should remain about the same. Because of the way that we do the speed zone study, we should be setting the speed at a speed that people are comfortable traveling. I think there is some speed creep, but it depends on the situation. Again, that sometimes you'll set a speed, you'll go from 35 to 45 or 45 to 35, and you won't really see a change in what people travel because they're traveling what they feel comfortable traveling.
Any other questions? Representative Gilman.
Doug, with this amendment, we'd have automobiles going 70 and conceivably trucks going 65. Without the amendment, I think the difference would be 10 miles. Would the department then consider 5 miles as the adequate difference between truck and cars?
Chair Brown, Representative Gilman, I'll let Troy give his answer to this question, because the answer is it's debatable. It's a debatable question whether 5 or 10 is better. Personally, in my judgment, I believe I don't like large separations in speed, because I think, particularly in rural areas, that you tend to come up on vehicles too fast if you're not paying attention. But let me give you the other side of the coin, which Troy has.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilman. There are studies that indicate the 5 mile differential would be safer in relationship to the items that Doug's presenting as far as passing and approach speed. However, one of the things to consider also is speed has an impact in the energy released in a crash. The faster, the heavier the load, the more energy that's there, and also in relationship to the infrastructure that the heavier vehicles travel on. It's the faster the speed and the more weight, the more energy is pushed into the road, such as the bridges and things that you've heard about and talked about already.
Mr. Chair, and this is just a comment, I would prefer to see that differential stay at 10 miles. And I know you may say it's safer. I've driven in just outside of Washington, D.C., and I think the trucks and cars go the same speed, at least in practicality they do on the road. And it is a mess. As a matter of fact, you really have to speed up to be able to pass a truck, and I think it's ridiculous. So I don't ever want Oregon to become that sort of an environment.
As I read this bill, the Department of Transportation would have the option of maintaining the truck speed where it's at. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. This is an optional permissive bill.
Yeah, and so it would just allow you to raise the speed, truck speed to 65, but not it's not mandatory. Any other representatives?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will we still be governed by the basic rule? You know, if the sun shines like this morning, can you still do 85 and not get a ticket? Or is this going to make it more defined for the police to be able to cite the people?
Mr. Chairman and Representative's Honor, the interstates would be speed limits. The basic rule is a secondary law that officers could use. If there's 6 inches of snow on the ground and somebody's doing 45 and the officer believes that's too fast, the officer can use the basic rule at that time. But this bill just deals with interstates, which would be limits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, gentlemen. Representative Miller's staff is here. Did you want to make any comments? Okay, thank you. Let's see, we had a motion, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Is there any other discussion? Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
On the dash ones.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Excuse.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Well, we can carry it, huh? The dash one amendments are adopted. I'd entertain a motion then on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill, what's the number again? 2501, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Zahner moves House Bill 2501 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
I just want to let you know that I will be voting no on this bill because of two reasons. One is concern about safety. I do believe as we increase the speed limit, as we've heard from testimony here from ODOT, that there is concern about safety issues and also fuel consumption, which since we're in the middle of a war right now, I'm very concerned about the increase in the cost of gasoline and also fuel efficiency is a big factor. Every time we raise speed limits, people drive faster and we get a decrease in fuel efficiency. So that's why I'll be voting no this morning.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Greenland.
Mr. Chair, I'll be voting no as well. I do believe that raising the speed limit will raise the average speed. My experience in driving to Seattle, it's very clear to me that when it's 70 miles an hour, people drive closer to 80, and when it's 65, people drive closer to 75, and I think 75 is fast enough. And I don't think there's any purpose served by raising the speed limits. I think it's not in the interest of the public health of our community.
Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Representative Dingfelder.
No.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenleaf.
No.
Representative Mabry.
Aye, excuse.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion have received a majority passes. And Carrier, Representative Miller. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. So this doesn't have to go to Ways and Means?
Janet's shaking her head.
Well, the question I had is signage, if this goes into effect and signage has to be replaced, doesn't it have a fiscal?
Yes, Mr. Chair. If there is a fiscal, you have it. It does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee. You could add one. You'd have to go back and reconsider your vote at this point. What the fiscal impact statement says is that the agency has some money in their budget to do engineering studies if they choose to focus the money that way. And if they do raise the speed limit, they would have to put up additional signs.
Well, the concern that I have is, given our current fiscal situation with the budget, I realize it's up to ODOT's discretion, but I just want to make sure that that's considered upon passage of this bill.
Yeah, these are gas tax funds as opposed to general fund dollars.
No, I realize that.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair,
and
maybe I'm wrong, but this doesn't automatically raise the speed limit. It allows it to be raised, but doesn't automatically raise it.
Right.
Okay. Apparently, we don't need to have a referral to Ways and Means. And so, and we have a carrier for the bill. So I'll close the public hearing on our work session on 2501 and open the work session on House Bill 2518. Janet, can you?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2518 was a bill brought to the committee. Two bills were brought to the committee by Representative Cruz. 2518 originally. The original bill would have converted basic rule speeds all to speed limits. And Representative Cruz also had a bill that would have made going 30 miles over the speed limit reckless driving. I don't know if you remember the discussion of that, but the criminal defense lawyers and others talked about not really wanting to go to put 30 miles over the speed limit into the reckless driving statutes. What the Dash 1 amendments do is make going over 30 miles an hour over the speed limit, take it from a Class A traffic infraction to a Class C misdemeanor. So it does create a crime, but it does not put it into the reckless driving statutes. The reason the amendments are in 2518 instead of Representative Cruz's other bill was that the other bill was relating to reckless driving, and he couldn't amend it to do what he wanted to do, so he took his amendments to this bill. And so this bill is 2518. The Dash 1 amendments, again, replace the original bill and increase the penalty level for exceeding a speed limit or posted speed by more than 30 miles an hour from a Class A traffic violation to a Class C misdemeanor. Mr. Chair, there is a fiscal impact statement for this bill, and the amendments, we talked about the amendments to the chair of the Judiciary Committee because it does create a crime. The chair of the Judiciary Committee said it would be his preference to see the bill in Judiciary as well if this committee does pass it out to add a referral to the Judiciary Committee.
Yes, good question.
Certainly. Representative Greenland.
Janet, was this viewed in light of the bill we just passed, 2501, because with 2501,
allowing a maximum speed of 70 miles an hour, 95 miles an hour will not be 30 miles over the speed limit. Is it intended to...
Mr. Chair, what usually happens if there's a conflict like that is that it's picked up later. Probably if both of these bills make it to the Senate, they'll need to make an adjustment to one or the other of the bills to indicate that. Because we can't assume the passage of 2501 and amend this bill at this point.
But is it the intent to have it at 30 miles over, or is it was it Representative Cruz's intent to make it 95, even if the speed limit was 70 or 75?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenleaf, I'm not sure if I know the answer to that.
This could have been dependent on the speed limit, I suppose. It looked like he intended to have a 95 maximum, whatever, even if the highway speed limit was 75. 95 seems fast enough.
Do you need a motion?
Yes. I guess it'd be I need to entertain a motion to adopt the dash ones or not.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2518.
Representative Dingfelder moves that we adopt the dash one amendment to 2518. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that we re-refer House Bill 2518 to Judiciary. Do we need to do that with a due-pass recommendation?
No, not necessarily.
No, you don't have to.
Okay. So I move that we re-refer House Bill 2518-1 to Judiciary. With no recommendation?
With no recommendation. Representative Dingfelder moves that we refer House Bill 2518 as amended to the Judiciary Committee without any recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Excuse.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. The bill will be referred to the Judiciary. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2518 and open the work session on House Bill 2455. Janet, can you bring us up to speed on this one, too?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2455 was the bill that exempted towing companies and vehicle repair businesses from requirements to have a vehicle dealer certificate when the business sells vehicles acquired through possessory liens. You have at your place dash three amendments. These merely combine the two amendments you had at the February 21st meeting. The dash one amendments applied the exemption to lien claimants who sell or offer for sale vehicles being sold to foreclosed possessory liens, as well as vehicles acquired through possessory liens. So it limits the exemption to those instances and requires the lien claimants to keep records sufficient to establish that all vehicles offered for sale were acquired by possessory liens. So it adds a record-keeping requirement and requires those records to be made available to the Department of Transportation on request. It also authorizes the department to impose civil penalties of up to $1,000 for violation of the provisions and adds then the dash two amendments that you had that day were adding an emergency clause, so the dash three amendments combine those two and add the emergency clause. And Mr. Chair, this bill has a minimal fiscal impact. The dash two amendments and the dash one amendments did.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Is Kelly Taylor here? Kelly?
There she is.
Yeah. She comes when I call, don't she? could I ask you to come up and explain the Dash 3 amendments?
On
2455.
Have I seen them?
Yes.
Essentially, they're a combination of the Dash 1 and Dash 2.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. The Dash 3s are, the bill, the way it's drafted, is really broad. And the Dash 3s narrow it down and just say that you're exempt from being a dealer if you're a lien claimant who sells or offers for sale vehicles at the auction, which is normally how you foreclose on a lien. And then if it doesn't sell at the auction, you then take possession of it. And currently today, trying to sell a vehicle at an auction, you are exempt. That is the one piece that the AG has said, yes, that is exempt. This takes it just a step further and says, and if you get stuck with that car at the auction, nobody buys it, you may then attempt to sell that vehicle after the auction, and you are still exempt from being a dealer because it's the same car obtained under the same reason you had it to begin with. And then it adds in, and this is, these record keeping is the one thing that we really, last interim, the House Transportation Committee asked us to look at this and work with folks, and we did. We got the towers together and used dealers and new dealers and us. And the one thing we realized is, towers aren't under any obligation to keep records or make those records available to us if we were to investigate them for acting as something outside of what they should be doing. And so what this does, the first part of Section 3, lines 9 through 16, are talking about that they can sell it at the auction or sell it after the auction, those things that they've obtained through a lien, which means the cars that they towed, and then somebody didn't pay the bill. And then the last part from line 17 through the bottom of page 1 and then through 2 is talking about them keeping records and making those records available to us and us being able to issue civil penalties if they act like they're not supposed to, which is violating the rules of this section, not keeping records, et cetera, or selling cars that they're not supposed to. And that was the one thing that we realized when we had the work group through the interim is that they are not under current obligation to keep records. They may make them available to us, but, you know, they don't have to, and why would they if they thought they were doing something wrong? And so this would make them keep records and make them available to us, and that's basically what they do. So it's putting into statute the first part in Section 3, lines 19 through 16, the current practice, some of it of which the AG says is okay and some of it which is current practice but the AG said would need a dealer's license. That's the after-auction sales. And saying, no, either one, that's been current practice, it's okay because your lien claimant's the same vehicle. And the rest of it is talking about keeping records so that we can tell what they are doing.
I'm representing Dean Kellner.
Thank you, Kelly. A question I have is, I mean, one of the concerns I have is just protecting the consumer. I mean, that's
sure.
Clear. And obviously, we don't want to make it a hardship for some of the smaller towers, especially ones that are only selling a couple of cars a month. But I'm trying to reconcile between selling a couple of cars a month with a larger amount, and it sounds like the larger amount would be mostly after an auction if they can't sell these cars at the auction. So is that correct? I mean, after an auction, if they can't sell it, then they're going to take them back and try to sell them privately.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, that's correct. And they may be selling them. They may be selling them to the public. They may also be trying to sell them to a wrecking yard, someone who's going to part them out just for scrap metal. I mean, typically, if they're not selling, it's because they're not worth very much. And I remember the one gentleman testifying when the bill was heard before that, on an average, they get about $30 if they're just scrap metal. But sometimes they have to clean them up and take hazardous material out of them, things like that, before they can even sell them to that scrap metal person. So, yeah, they are selling them afterwards, but it's a variety of things people are selling them to.
So it could be to a consumer follow-up?
It could be to a consumer, yes.
And another question I had regarding the record keeping. And could you explain how the record keeping would be different from if there was a dealer's license required? I guess that's what I'm trying to weigh here, is the record keeping that you're going to require under an exemption versus the record keeping that would be required if the towers had to, you know, register and get a certificate as a dealer, and how you would judge those differences should there be a complaint made to you by a consumer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, well, this, what the Dash 3s do is give us rule authority to say exactly what records will be kept. And it was our intent, and we've discussed this with the towers and with the work group, it would be our intent that they would have to keep track of, from the very beginning, where they got the car, you know, the call, what police agency or whoever, how they got it. Was it off of my property? Was it off of a street? Where did they get it from? Paperwork that shows that they followed the auction guidelines that are set by Department of Justice for doing a public sale. And then the paperwork of who they sold it to. So that if we got a call, mm-hmm. and we were to go out to a lot and there were, say, 10 cars there for sale or 5 cars there for sale or however many, we'd say, I want to see the paperwork in every one of these cars and any that have come through here. And they better be able to pull up a file in every one of those cars and show us where they got it from, that everything was followed according to what they were supposed to do, the notices to the owners of the vehicles, the whole bit, everything that, you know, from beginning to end that's been in their possession, everything should be in there. And a dealer has to keep track of who they got it from and who they sold it to, et cetera, and copies of the paperwork. Now, there's another bill in another committee that's also touching on this, and there's been a work group working on that. And in that bill, it's House Business and Labor, I think it is. It's Representative Close's bill, committee. And in that one, we are amending it to where the towers will have to send DMV a notice when they take it in their possession from the auction. Like, they take it to an auction and it doesn't sell and it becomes theirs. They'll send us a paperwork very similar to what a dealer sends to us when they take something in their inventory. When they sell it, they're going to have to send us a notice, just like the dealer does, when it's been sold to somebody. And that's to keep our records updated, you know, so it's no longer just looks like Kelly Taylor owns it. Here's paperwork coming in from a tower. We can flag the record. They took it in their possession. Here's paperwork coming in that they sold it. And scratching off the tags to devoid the plates and giving them the authority to issue a 10-day trip permit, much like the bill you all passed for dealers, so that the person can then drive for 10 days legally, but that will force them into getting the paperwork put in their name, the title and registration work. So this bill plus that bill complementing will make it very similar to some of the paperwork the dealers have to do.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Greenland.
Kelly, do you have rule authority now to define what a public auction is?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenland, that falls under Department of Justice. Yes, they do, but we don't.
There is rule authority to define what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Representative's honor.
Yeah. Well, Representative Dingfelder, our minds must work, great minds work the same channel. No, I was trying to find the difference, and I guess you did explain the difference between what the Dash 2 would do and a current dealer's type. Mm-hmm. Is it more restrictive or is it less restrictive? I mean, if they're very, very similar, why are we even going through trying to get the exemption?
Representative Brown and Representative Honor, they're similar in some of the paperwork. They're not similar in all of the requirements. The fees and things are not the same. Dealer education requirements are not the same. We're not making towers in these bills go through dealer education courses. There are some differences.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. It seemed in testimony one of the big problems was whether or not the tower that towed the rig actually went through the process of going into that auction. You know, whether they skirted that a little bit.
Mr. Chair and Representative's Honor, that's one of the things we've talked about with the work group that Representative Close has had going, and Pete Shepard, who is from Department of Justice and very familiar with that process, has been there. And we've looked into that, how many hour notice or day notice before somebody, before a tow or a police agency has to tell somebody they've got the car, and looking at whether or not to shorten that down. And so those things have been looked at that have to do with before you can sell it and giving the notice of the auction. The paperwork will have to be in the file. If they didn't do the right steps as outlined by DOJ rules, either DOJ or us would be able to issue a civil penalty depending on what they violated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Kelly.
Is there any other question, Kelly? Kelly, could you explain to us why the minimal physical impact, how did you come to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, we only have 7 investigators statewide, and we have to stretch those resources among all of the folks that we regulate. And if there is a complaint, we'll investigate it. But we don't get a tremendous number of complaints about towers. So if we got one, we would use existing resources. We would not be asking for more positions. We don't believe it would equal. We don't believe the complaints will equal an additional position. So based on, we do go out to towers today. It's just whether or not they'll let us look at records. Excuse me. So that's the explanation behind the minimum physical.
Okay, and do they have to try the auction route first? Is that a requirement? That
Mr. Chair, yes, they do.
Okay.
Yeah.
One more question. One of the components that I obviously dropped from this here with this proposal would be the dealer education required under a licensed auto dealer. Can you tell me how much, what's the impact been on the education component of the requirement to be an auto dealer? Has it had an effect? Has it lowered the complaint ratios or the...
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to remember. I got asked something similar over on the Senate side when they were doing a dealer bill. My memory is that before dealer education, the bulk of our complaints came from used car dealers. That's one of the reasons they brought it forth, was to try to get at it. And today, they still make up 3/4 of our complaints. About 75% come from used car dealers. We don't see that it's had an effect on complaints or anything like that. We still get the bulk of the complaints from used car dealers, and those are the only entities that have to take the continuing education. The if there were a brand new dealer coming in, they may have to take the course, but basically all of the entities except for used car dealers, be it RV dealers or new car dealers, are exempt from having to take dealer education. The only dealers that have to take education are used vehicle dealers. So if you sell used cars or you sell, I guess, like boat trailers because they're a vehicle, then you would have to take the course. But no, we haven't really seen any improvement, I guess you could say, in the number of complaints coming in, or the fact that the ratio has shifted off of used car dealers from to something else. It's still, the bulk of it is still used car dealers, and those are the folks that have to take the course.
Thank you, Kelly. Is there any other questions, Kelly? Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, Janet, did we have a motion on the dash threes?
I don't think so.
We didn't have to.
I move the dash three amendments to 2455.
Representative Greenlick moves the dash three amendments to House Bill 2455. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, adopted. Chair would entertain a motion on the bill. There is one. Representative
Gilman. Chair, I move House Bill 2455-3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gilman moves House Bill 2455 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative's honor.
Mr. Chair, I'm just in no man's land on the bill. A little discomfort. I'm going to vote no on it for that reason. I hope before it all gets done and settled that I'll feel a little more comfortable with this.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can understand where Representative's honor is on this. My constituents want this bill and my constituents don't want this bill. So it's like, what's the best way to go? What the deciding factor for me on this one is the clause that opens the records. And I don't want to lose that at this point. I mean, this is, the bill kind of looks like an agreement that was reached. I mean, I'm sure neither one of the parties wanted both of these things in the bill, but they're both there. And so I want to make sure that the department has the ability to go in and check records on these, and then maybe down the line, if there's abuse that is recorded, we can look at that.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments?
Yep, Mr. Brown, Representative Brown, I just want to say I share some of the concerns that have been raised. I, too, have heard from constituents on both sides of this issue. My main concern is consumer protection, and I do hope that ODOT will come back with possibly a report to us next session and let us know how the rules are working, because, it's putting the onus, once again, on enforcement with limited. When I hear 7 inspectors statewide, I do have concerns to make sure that this is implemented effectively. So I'm going to vote yes today, but would like to see next session to come back with a report, because I think our main objective here is to make sure that consumers are protected when they're purchasing these vehicles.
Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Greenlake.
Yes.
Representative Mabry.
Excuse.
Representative Zahner.
No.
Representative Beyer.
Yes.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Do I have a carrier? A willing carrier.
I think Representative Zahner is a carrier.
I think the sponsor of the bill should carry.
Yeah. Okay, the chair will carry. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2455 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3032. We have any signed up?
Yes.
And Janet, can you give us the rundown on the bill, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3032 would permit a motorcycle operator to turn left on a steady red arrow if the green arrow is activated by the weight of the vehicle and the steady red arrow has not changed to green after 2 complete cycles of the lights. It bases the lawful left turn under these circumstances to the operator exercising due care to avoid an accident, yielding right-of-way to the traffic and pedestrians that are lawfully within or approaching the intersection. The bill creates the offense of an improper left turn at a steady red arrow for violation of these conditions and classifies the new offense as a Class C traffic infraction for violation punishable by a maximum of $150 fine. Mr. Chair, I think the sponsor and the requester are both here. Thank you.
Good morning, Representative March. I apologize. I didn't see you slip into the room.
That's quite all right.
He's a still.
He's so light.
Need a motion detector.
he didn't trip the weight.
I didn't trip the weight sensor. That was it. I'm too light. Light on my feet. Well, Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. And this is one of those classic bills that comes to you the traditional way things are supposed to work in the legislature. A constituent contacted me, Clark Brooker, who brought up a problem that he has discerned when he is riding his motorcycle. Motorcycles do not always trip the sensors that are embedded in the road, particularly in the left turn lanes. And as you know, currently, if you turn left on a red signal, you would get written up for it. Well, one of the problems, when he told me about this, I went, oh, yeah. You know, I've seen that happen. There's some motorcycle up there at the front of the left turn lane. I'm about 4 cars back. And the motorcycle didn't trip the sensor. So I said I'd certainly put the bill in, and we just have to make sure that it was done right, and they'd only be able to turn left after a reasonable amount of time, and that's Mr. Brooker suggested 2 sequences, and that it would be safe to do so. So hence the bill before you, and I'll leave the bulk of the testimony to others, and just thank you for hearing the bill, and If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dingfelder.
Representative March, could this apply to bicycles as well? I often find I have the same issue.
Well, I didn't write it as that, but I would consider that a friendly amendment if you'd like to prepare those amendments.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
And I'd be happy to carry the bill at future reference if this bill gets out of the committee. So.
All right, thank you. Mr. Brooker.
Yes, my name is Clark Brooker, chairman and members of the committee. I'm here because of a safety issue. Since I ride my motorcycle to work almost every day for 9 years, I'm right now retired. At 4 a.m. in the morning, I would wait at, I'm not sure the streets, either Harney or 45th and Johnson Creek, to make a left-hand turn. Normally, I would wait for a couple of cycles and the light wouldn't change, and when it didn't change, I'd just go ahead and make the left turn on my way to work. And a few years ago, police officer was sitting at the intersection one morning, so I waited through seven cycles of the signal, thinking, well, this has got to change pretty soon, but it didn't, and I went on over and went on through the intersection. Of course, she pulled me over, threatened to give me a ticket, and I asked her what she would do if she was in this situation, how she would solve it, and her answer was, well, she'd find a different route to work or possibly go through the parking lot. I says, well, neither one of those were acceptable. During the same time, I was reading American Motorcycle Association magazine. Not only did they have the problem in other areas, they suggested that maybe you look through the state statute to see if there was some revision or some law that would cover that. I looked, well, I'm getting ahead here. I said, imagine like sitting at 92nd and Powell, I don't know how many are familiar with Portland, at 5 p.m. on a weekday, which is a very busy intersection, trying to make a left turn. The light doesn't change. The cars are backing up. People behind you are getting really upset, honking the horn. The safety concern becomes if you pull out on the intersection enough to give the car behind you room to trip the light, then you're really out in a dangerous area. If you don't, well, then, you know, I guess you'd say road rage or something like that would be a consideration. Anyway, after reading all of the, I bought the Oregon Revised Statute, Volume 15. I read through it as much as I could, and I have not been able to find anywhere that it says what to do if the light does not change. The right turn lane is not a problem because you could make a right turn and then make a U-turn and come back and proceed on your way. But left turn, they have no options. So because of that, I'm proposing that you wait for two cycles of the light, and if it doesn't change, it probably is not going to change. And at that time, you could treat it as an uncontrolled intersection or just proceed through on a safe manner. So please help me try and make it safe and legal to ride. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brooker. You know, could I have Doug Tindall, could you come up, please, and explain to us how this piece of equipment works?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, good morning again. Doug Tindall, State Maintenance Engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm not sure the two specific intersections cited in this case exactly how the equipment works, but I give you a little bit of history on actuated signals. The original installations were a metal plate which was, as this bill indicates, weight activated or actuated, and the problem that's brought up here is a correct assessment. Those weight actuated plates took a pretty good whack to get them to trip. So there may still be some out there, and that may be the case in these intersections. The more recent technology involves loops in pavement that measure an inductive, put a current through the loop, which sets up a magnetic field. So when you cross through it with a metal object, a car, motorcycle, bicycle, garbage can lid, it will cause a trip of the signal. The initial installations of those two were not perfect, and so There were problems with how often they picked up. There's also problems with the wires breaking, although if they fail, they should fail. If they're using new equipment, they should fail on, which means you'd always get a trip. But now they are very sensitive. In fact, we're using them in bicycle lanes to get bicycle signals, a smaller loop in a bicycle lane. But they are, the new stuff is very sensitive and wouldn't be subject to this type of problem.
Thank you, Doug. Any questions of any of the Representative Dingfeld?
Thank you. Doug, I have a question. Can you give sort of a guess as to how, what percentage of the signals now have the newer type versus the older type? So I'm trying to get a sense of, is this going to be phased out so this won't be a problem? Because I sometimes on my bicycle it does trip it, and other times it doesn't. So I know that's probably going to be hard, especially within the city of Portland, but if you can give us a guess.
Jared Brown, Representative Dingfelder, I probably can't. I can tell you on the state highway system, I don't think we've got any pressure-activated left on the state highway system. Might be one or two, but I can't. Nothing pops to my mind. As far as where the cities and counties are, I'm really not sure.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Greenwood.
Yes, thank you, sir. I mean, this does raise an interesting issue. If we pass this, will it affect the ordinances of the city of Portland?
Chair Brown, Representative Greenlick, the citation that was threatened would have been under a state law, a state statute. I don't believe that, I'm not aware, I shouldn't say I don't believe, I'm not aware of any particular ordinances within the city of Portland. It would have been cited
state
under
state statute controls.
Yes.
In the city.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Could I have Sam Hochberg?
Hochberg.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
You're right.
Have my testimonies being distributed at this time? Shall I proceed, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Oh, thank you. I'm here to testify in favor of this bill, HB 3032. My name is Sam Hochberg, H-O-C-H-B-E-R-G. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon for 20 years. I have an office in downtown Portland. And I've been riding motorcycles since 1971. I'm very familiar with motorcycle issues and motorcycle law. A substantial portion of my practice is devoted to motorcycle issues, including motorcycle accident claims, but a great number of pro bono matters for the motorcycle community. I'm a member of a number of organizations, and here to urge your passage of this bill. And I can speak from personal experience that many times I've been in the position, rather awkward one, that this bill would remedy. Motorcycles just don't always trigger, as I'm sure you've heard previous to me today, the sensing device for traffic signals that's embedded in the pavement. It's usually because either they're not heavy enough or because you can't quite find the exact spot on a motorcycle. These things generally sense the size and weight of the vehicle is a major issue. Cars don't present this problem, and frankly no other type of intersection does, because if I'm on my motorcycle and I want to make a right turn, obviously I can make a right on red after I stop anyway, and if I want to go forward, worst case, I can pull up to the right and I can make a series of rights or turn into a driveway and come around and go through to end up going straight ahead. But if I'm in a left turn, I'm stuck. I have nowhere to go. And frequently a left turn lane is boxed in as well. So that's why I think this bill is so important. And of course, if the sensor doesn't change, you're just stuck there. Unless you break the law, which I've been forced to do from time to time on my motorcycle. For me to get another vehicle to trip that left turn sensor when my motorcycle won't, I have to also perform an unsafe maneuver. I have to pull out and pull my bike out into the intersection where I'm not supposed to be, wave a car in, and have the car try to trip the sensor. It's not a terrific place to be, but it's sometimes what we're forced to do. And this in itself sometimes takes one or two cycles of the light as it is. I think the safer way, obviously, is to have the law as it is, and if it's adequately publicized, it should be should not be any issue for enforcement. If there isn't another vehicle there, if it's in the middle of the night or in an odd hour, as I know, I believe... one of the testimony was about earlier, then you're just stuck there. All you can do is go through the light if you have to make a left. I don't see any downside, It should have the desired effect to avoid the necessity of unsafe maneuvers by motorcyclists if they're stranded by an unresponsive signal. There just isn't much else you can do. Now, some of the most modern signals, in some instances, sometimes have something that's not embedded in the pavement, in which case the problem doesn't exist, but it exists in many, many intersections throughout the state. And in response to one of the committee members' questions, having represented many people in the past in assisting motorcyclists in traffic matters, and in the past I had been a criminal defense lawyer as well, I've never seen a local city ordinance or county ordinance of any sort governing this sort of thing. A traffic signal device is always a matter of the state regulations and not the city ordinance. And thank you for allowing me to present this. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Is there any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Lyle, did you want to... you have any testimony this morning?
No, sir. It has been very helpful.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Is there any other discussion? If not, we'll close the public hearing. And it was scheduled only for a public hearing this morning. Is there any other business for the committee? Seeing none, if there isn't, we are adjourned.